Welcome to Interchange. I'm Doug Storm. Today's show is Storied States. Our music throughout is by the New York Art Quartet off of the album Old Stuff, comprised of live recordings from Copenhagen in 1965, but first released in 2010 on Cuneiform Records, showing that the music of the band was still vital. Time had not effaced its impact. This is Potisda, which is Norwegian and means, conveniently, on Tuesday. Today's show is something of a counter-companion to last week's program, Storied Into Being, with anthology editor and literature professor Martin Puchner. That show followed the stories which accompanied writing technology on its roughly 5,000-year journey from the accountants of ancient Mesopotamia to the entrepreneurship of Benjamin Franklin. And what should be no surprise, we saw how literature runs a parallel course with state power and class domination. Even old Franklin saw fit to become Postmaster General of the United States to facilitate his business interests. In Storied States, we come to find out just why that is, by means of examining the shift in how humans lived, moving from hunter-gatherers to sedentary farmers. And contrary to official narrative, it wasn't because humans couldn't wait to give up the so-called arduous life of necessary mobility and settle down. In fact, the opposite appears to be true. Humans had to be compelled into lives of drudgery, normally lived in the shackled service of a non-producing elite, priests, kings, scribes, the very classes of people who end up writing and propagating our canonical literary and sacred texts. At the center of it all, facilitating indenture and servitude, is grain. Rice, wheat, and corn in particular all turn out to be wonderful tools of the taxman and the military campaign. Returning to Interchange to continue the work of unsettling us is James Scott. He's Sterling Professor of Political Science and Professor of Anthropology and founding director of the Program in Agrarian Studies at Yale University. The author of many books, including the classic Seeing Like a State, his most recent is Against the Grain, a deep history of the earliest states. It might also be called In Praise of Collapse, or Better Living Through Barbarity. We begin with the upending of the long-time archaeological orthodoxy that the domestication of plants and animals led directly to sedentism and fixed-field agriculture. Instead, humans had domesticated plants and animals for about 4,000 years before the agricultural villages appeared that made city-states like Uruk even a possibility. So just why did humanity remain uncivilized for a period of time roughly equivalent to all of our written history after learning to plant and harvest? We'll turn now to Jim Scott for the answer. Jim, your purpose, and you set it up for yourself, right? You say, I thought I knew certain things about the sort of archaeological history of the world, and I discovered when I went back to review what I had been doing and update it with the current literature that that the things I knew were no longer correct or weren't even close to being right.
That's correct. I've been teaching a seminar with other people for the last 25 years, actually, on the comparative study of agrarian societies, and I had been giving the introductory lecture on the domestication of fire and plants and animals and the earliest states. And I had revised that lecture from time to time, but I realized it was out of date. And when I got asked to give a couple of formal lectures, the Tanner lectures, I thought, oh, well, I just finished a book and I didn't want to sort of undertake a huge project. I thought at least I could update those two lectures, which I knew to be not entirely up to date. Mm-hmm. And what astounded me was that to go back and read the archaeology and history, I realized that my lectures were wrong in some fundamental ways. And yes, so it resulted in a detour for me of a three-year detour, at the end of which I then produced what I think we now understand about those earliest states and those early permanent settlements.
Yeah, one of the things that the book does really well is lay out
the way that geography is important, the way that climate is important, but also the way that this is a somewhat small story that becomes very large. And part of the, it's again part of the interesting, parallel between this book and I guess the perspective of Puckner's book was that when you look at the narrative and even visit the places, you have to kind of remember this is not, you know, down the street. This is not New York. This is not Chicago. This is Uruk. You know, this is at best, you know, 25,000, 50,000 people, and usually far fewer people involved in how things begin. And then, and there also is the, I guess you start primarily with the archaeological record of what is a long kind of percolation of the technologies of growing grain.
Correct. So I think you've actually captured the spirit of what I want to say quite well, in the sense that these are, if you like, the very earliest and quite small experiments in sedentary living on a substantial scale, not substantial by contemporary terms, but substantial for their terms. These were tiny little dots on the map, and yet these, what I call grain modules of population and concentrated power, ended up being the most powerful colonizing forces that helped to create states and then came to dominate what had previously been a world dominated by hunters and gatherers and foragers.
So set us up with what was wrong, Jim. What did you have wrong? What did the archaeologists have wrong? I think there was one person in particular you point out, not necessarily that she was entirely wrong, but rather that it was a prevailing attitude that one went to grain farming when your back was against the wall. That was Bostrup, is that right?
Yes, that's right. Esther Bostrup, mm-hmm. a great, actually, Danish woman economist whose work I revere. However, in that particular case, it was what I call the backs to the wall theory. And she was interested in European cultivation at a much later date. And she thought that the resort to the plow and plow agriculture only took place when population had increased to a point where people absolutely had to get more out of a small plot of land than they had to previously. And so they, in a sense, were forced to the plow, partly because there was no longer a large frontier. They could no longer practice slash and burn agriculture in the forest and so on. The most important thing I think I had wrong that got me onto this particular track is that I had not realized that the firm evidence for domesticated plants and for a certain casual planting of grains, evidence for that exists 4,000 years before anything like villages living largely by agriculture appear. And so 4,000 years is a long time. If we measure backward from contemporary times, we're back to 2000 BC. Mm-hmm. So the question then became, under the standard narrative, it was assumed that once we had mastered the domestication of grains and could create fixed fields, that we would do it immediately and on a large scale, and that made possible civilization. So my largest initial query was, why did it take 4,000 years for us to become planters, if you like, on fixed fields?
This is Doug Storm on Interchange. My guest is James Scott, author of Against the Grain, A Deep History of the Earliest States, which turns out to be the story of scribes, taxes, and slavery.
The idea being, as you say, sort of looking backwards as if this were the pinnacle of advanced living, to become a planter and become sedentary, and that would put pressure in its sense on becoming that way, that why would you want to hunt and forage as if that's the bad thing when you could be a farmer or sedentary, stop moving around? The reverse seems to be true, right?
Correct. And what I think people are unlikely to understand about the classical world of hunting and gathering, or even today, the hunters and gatherers and foragers who still exist in the world, We know that they don't spend more than half of their time working at all. So the idea that these people are a day away from starvation and go into the forest hoping to stumble on game is a kind of misunderstanding of their world, in the sense that they are masters of when certain trees and plants fruit. They're masters of the migrations of birds and fish and of mammals, and that they pretty largely intercept these migrations and are able to get much of their subsistence in a very short period of time. I can give you an interesting example from New England. If you look at low water at the rivers that go out from Connecticut into the Long Island Sound and the Atlantic, you'll find these remnants of ancient structures, a couple of which have been rebuilt, which are funnels, essentially. And the function of these funnels for Native Americans was to channel the eels as they were going to sea, usually toward the end of September, into these narrow passages where they could be caught in baskets and on a large scale, salted and dried and smoked. And so Native Americans were able to get most of their annual protein supply in a couple of weeks of intensive work by timing and capturing these migrations. The same is true, of course, for bird migrations. The same is true in the Middle East for the gazelle. The gazelle migrations were the big migrations in the Middle East. And before agriculture, and even during agriculture, there was an effort to create actually funnels that look like the ones at the bottom of rivers that were used to funnel the gazelles into a killing field where they could be killed more easily. And in that case, they were able also to get most of their protein in a fairly short time.
Yeah, you had mentioned this, I think, in a previous book as well, the idea of that particular life that has a certain tempo to it and understands the way that those, migrations and seasons, and is it a person, a human being in tune with the way the natural world operates?
Right. I make the argument, which is not necessary to the book's argument in general, mm-hmm. but I make the argument that if you look at the life of foragers and hunters and gatherers, they have to be the masters of many, many natural cycles of ripening, migrations, and so on. And so they have to pay actually extremely close attention to the natural world. Whereas early agriculturalists got most of their calories from a single carbohydrate grain. And so, if you like, the tempo of their life was structured by the genetic needs of wheat and barley, which were the major crops that they were growing. And that's a much more narrow relationship to the natural world mm-hmm. than hunters and gatherers have. I'm actually very fond of the argument made about specialization and mm-hmm. The narrowing of focus that Alexis de Tocqueville mm-hmm. makes. De Tocqueville read Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, in which the example of the division of labor and therefore of human progress was the pin factory. Mm-hmm. And de Tocqueville read appreciatively The Wealth of Nations, but asked out loud, as it were, what one could expect from a man who spent the last 20 years putting heads on pins. and the point is that this is, it may be an efficient form of production, but it is, if you like, narrowing, and it's what they call in the trade union world de-skilling, mm-hmm. the way the assembly line confines you to a single operation.
Mm-hmm. It's time for a break. This is Old Stuff from 1965 by New York Art Quartet. More with political scientist and author James Scott when Interchange returns on WFHB.
Welcome back to Interchange. I'm Doug Storm. My guest today is James Scott, author of Against the Grain. In this segment, with monoculture comes monotheism and the drudgery of work. But other modes of sustaining human life existed at the same time as early civilization and involved living in tempo with the natural. Hunter-gatherers spent only about 50% of their time seeking sustenance. And who would choose to till and irrigate the land when you can just spread seeds after seasonal floods? Well, it may not be, as you say, central to the argument of this book, but it is, I think, central to the argument overall, the narrowing of, I don't know what to say other than being, you know, the narrowing into a purpose and focus that isn't necessarily about I would call it the lie we get for, you know, expanding, flourishing, and progress, but the diminishment of capacity and possibility, which is a part of this story as well. The grain itself is a single, a monocultural environment. We talked last time too, I think, about sort of the monoculture of religion as well in many ways and how these kind of go hand in hand.
That's a very important question of monotheism. I don't do this in the book, but it is a logical extension, I think, of my argument to some extent, that hunters and gatherers and foragers live in what we call an animist world. Christians would have called it a pagan world. And for them, everything is enchanted. That is to say, everything is animated. A stream, a hill, a valley, a tree. They have their own kind of agency. Monotheism is a very different outlook on the world. And what is interesting to me is that, of course, monotheism arises exactly in the context that I'm writing about in these early civilizations, mm-hmm. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all of which place man in command of nature to have nature do his bidding. I think it's always phrased in the masculine gender.
Yeah, that's a further intrigue, I suppose. Again, as it's tied to the literacy or written tradition of these cultures as well, if we think of just the idea that in the Hebrew Bible that God is an author first and foremost, in some sense, right? He hands the tablets to Moses before he actually asks Moses to write them down for him and become a scribe to him. So it is an interesting, again, all these things in my head as I'm reading the book just keep sort of entangling in themselves. So I apologize if I keep going back and forth between your previous work and the interview with Puckner as well, just because they kind of all sort of dovetail into this story of civilization and who's writing the story. Part of what you do that I think is interesting to me as well is try to understand that 4,000-year gap. What's happening in that space where we do have some evidence or clear evidence that grain had been domesticated in a sense, or that the actual growing of grain had served in that way. I guess you move into the domus at this point as well, or does that come later? I'm not quite sure of the timeline there.
No, that comes somewhat later.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing, I think, for people to understand is that we associate southern Mesopotamia with an arid, sandy landscape in which you only get things to grow if you can irrigate them. The fact is that water levels are about 300 feet higher at 6,000 BC than they are today. And this meant that the Persian Gulf extended far up into the Mesopotamian floodplain, up to the very doors of Ur and Uruk, these very earliest states. And that meant that these were wetlands, and they were wetlands with a kind of pronounced dry season and a wet season, in which when the area started to dry out, you had this incredible pasturage for domesticated animals. You could grow plots. And when it was wet, you had all of the wetland animals, fish, and birds. So it was a kind, of course, it is seen in many places as the original Garden of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
And in that respect, it was an area of wetland abundance. And I owe this insight, elaborated by Jennifer Pornell, who wrote a great dissertation on this, I think. She's able to recover what the land form looked like 6,000 years ago in a remarkable way. And so what you had was wetland abundance where people would only practice ever one kind of agriculture, planting, and that was what I call flood retreat agriculture, which is what's practiced along the Nile as well. That is to say, if you have a gentle flood, the flood brings silt, nutritious silt. It kills competing vegetation. When the flood recedes, then you have a perfectly plowed field or harrowed field that's nutritious and no competing vegetation. And you can just throw seeds, broadcast seeds, and have a crop. And so that is the only form of agriculture. Notice that it's not using a plow.
Mm-hmm.
That's or draft animals. That's the only form of agriculture that lazy Homo sapiens were interested in doing. They had an abundant landscape. And that why, by the way, is always when there was plenty of land, the only thing that interested human beings was how to get as much nutrition as easily as possible with as little work from the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were not interested in the yield per unit per acre. They were interested in the yield per unit work.
Mm-hmm.
How hard did they have to work? Drudgery.
Mm-hmm.
And so because land was cheap and easily available, they avoided drudgery and exploited all these little micro ecosystems within this wetland area. And there was no need for them to plant crops. So they avoided it as long as they can. And how they got pushed into it is something I can't quite solve, because remember, I'm an outsider here. And there's a big debate about whether it is a change in climate, where people were driven back to the sources of water and were not able to spread out, whether it was population growth. So there's a worldwide argument about the causes of people to plant labor-intensive crops. It hasn't been solved, and I can't solve it. I just present the alternative explanations that are now available.
Mm-hmm.
This is Doug Storm on Interchange. My guest is James Scott, author of Against the Grain, A Deep History of the Earliest States, which turns out to be the story of scribes, taxes, and slavery.
Well, it does strike one as, you know, if you go ahead and take the logic of not working very hard, right, or working as hard as you need to and getting the sustenance you need, it strikes you again as not at all conducive, even in the worst conditions, to set up agriculture. You know, even if you're stuck with having no food, the goal had always been to move somewhere else, right? To find, you know, to keep finding other places. And the point we get to is to imagine that things are, I guess, contracted. And this is your point. I think the point you try to make in terms of how states begin is that some contractual, perhaps natural thing happens. I think you mentioned a small ice age at some point. And again, I don't know if I'm getting my timeline screwed up, but when the ability to, you know, be that multitasking kind of foraging hunter, farmer stops being so simple, people are gathered in one place in larger numbers, and then they begin to be utilized as tools in some sense. So we got, and that's where the argument is, you know, why would you ever want to be enslaved by the state? You know, how do you argue that that's the best way to be? How do we argue that working so hard for so little is cast as a good? So let's understand the domus at this point.
Yes, I guess the domus leads us to the question of sedentary living, of staying in the mm-hmm. same place. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize this until I got around to thinking actively about the book and its argument. I didn't quite realize that the assumption behind the domestication of grains and civilization is that once we domesticated grains, it made it possible for us to stay in the same place year-round.
Mm-hmm.
And the argument implicitly is that we had desperately wanted to do this.
Right.
And finally, the domestication of grains made it possible for us to stay in the same place. Well, what's interesting to me is that historically, when colonizing powers have tried to forcibly resettle people who have mobile forms of subsistence, they found themselves with a war on their hands.
Mm-hmm.
Most Native Americans were, you know, confined to reservations only as a result of having lost a war, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's interesting, it's the interesting part about the wetland abundance of southern Mesopotamia was that it was possible to not move a great deal. They were not long treks because it was such a rich wetland mosaic that one could stay roughly in the same zone and collect all the things one needed for a quite diverse diet and a healthy subsistence. And so the question is, what upsets that? And there the question of population and climate come in, and then you get the what I call the domus, which is the sedentary agriculture with a hearth, domesticated animals, crops, and families living in very close proximity and at high densities. And the one thing that is true about sedentism is that it almost always results in a huge spurt in births, in human fertility. Hunters and gatherers have essentially one child every 4 years, and agriculturalists have a child every 2.5 years, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, this makes a huge difference, even though sedentary populations are less healthy and actually mortality is quite high as well. But overall, over 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years, these agricultural settlements, because they're sedentary, actually produce huge growths in population, despite bad health, that overwhelm the demographic increase in hunters and gatherers.
Here's one more from the New York Art Quartet off of the album Old Stuff. This is Sweet V, which I'll interpret as alluding to the shape of the first known writing on clay tablets, wedged lines we know as cuneiform. Though their double edge both conveys the glories of language found in the Epic of Gilgamesh and hides the violence and drudgery of thousands of years of forced labor that make up the storied civilizations we praise as great human achievements. Welcome back to Interchange on WFHB. Our show today is Storied States and the Domestication of Fire, Plants, Animals, and finally, ourselves. And taxes. You can't have a state without grain. You can have grain without a state.
Grains like rice, wheat, and corn ripen above ground and at predictable times, making it very easy for the taxman to tend the tithe, or for an army to destroy it or steal it after harvest. You know, what's fascinating is that this single thing, right, this idea of this growth in reproductive rate, you know, both overcomes bad health, as you say, overcomes the mortality rate, and allows one to continue to go on being in the same place because you keep replacing yourself at a fast enough rate to continue laboring. It's an interesting, I guess, a difficult way to sometimes conceive of the, or to really think about these cultures, is the, again, the idea that you'd want to be sedentary, even though, as you describe it, the fact of this growth of population, the fact of growing numbers of animals, and as you say, the creatures that come along with them, the both invited beings and the uninvited creatures all come into the domus as well, and thus we begin to see disease and et cetera, et cetera. So it's like this thing that you imagine being a good, again, leads to multiple negative consequences on the population as a whole.
So one of the things I hope that the readers of my book will ponder is our term of domestication. Mm. That is, it seems to me that from one angle, my book is a story about a series of domestications. The first domestication is the domestication of fire, mm-hmm. distinguished between wildfire and controlled fires at the domus or the hearth. And then the domestication of plants. And each of the domestication means control over reproduction.
Mm-hmm.
So we control the reproduction of fire. We control the reproduction of plants and shape them to our needs. We control the reproduction of animals in the course of their domestication. And one could argue that we create the patriarchal family, the state does, in order to control the reproduction of women and to realize control of a growing population.
Mm-hmm.
And so one can see this as a series, and one could see that the function of the state is to domesticate Homo sapiens as well.
Right. Yeah. So
I don't draw that out in great detail, but
yes.
I invite my readers to see this progression as a series of domestications.
Well, it's enough because you move into the enslaved population as well, and you quote Aristotle also as the human, the lesser species of human, I suppose, as a particular tool. So it isn't hard to, of course, go there, that the domestication of humanity is kind of the end of state formation itself, I suppose.
The other person who actually draws this relationship in a very direct way is V. Gordon Childe, who wrote a book a long time ago called Man Makes Himself.
Mm.
It was probably the oasis theory of early civilization. Anyway, his argument, based on some interesting evidence, is that the domestication of animals led directly to the institutions of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
That as long as you're domesticating four-footed animals, you might as well domesticate two-footed animals as well,
mm-hmm.
and make them do your bidding and control their reproduction as well. Or if you can't, you can at least capture them from the wild and assemble them to do your bidding.
Mm-hmm. This is Doug Storm on Interchange. My guest is James Scott, author of Against the Grain, A Deep History of the Earliest States, which turns out to be the story of scribes, taxes, and slavery. Well, it makes sense. Once you craft it that way, or just see the ability to do so, and in this country itself, if we just stick to the culture of slavery that this country has as well, and you have our founding father like Thomas Jefferson talking about breeding patterns of his own enslaved right. population at the time, you see that very, very readily, that that's just an end point that makes sense in terms of controlling other beings to serve other beings, I guess.
Right? As someone who spent 20 years raising sheep and judging my success not just by the wool that I sheared from them, but mm-hmm. from my lamb crop. Mm-hmm. So people who held slaves mm-hmm. judge their success by the reproductive rate of the slaves themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the pattern of slavery in early states favors the capture of women and children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Partly because they're the reproductive part of the population. And the men, let's say, if we're talking about ancient Athens, the men are by and large sent to the silver mines and quarries in more or less chain gang slavery, whereas the women and children are incorporated into Greek society.
Mm. Well, it's a good trip through those cultures as well, the book, after you sort of say, well, grain isn't necessarily the reason for state formation, but without grain, there is no state. This is a primary point of the book, right? That you could have grain without states, but that a state can't be without some kind of taxable grain, for the most part. Tax being a key issue here, right?
Right. So, yes, I make an argument, which I've actually made elsewhere,
mm-hmm.
about the importance of a grain. The word grain is actually meant really quite specifically in terms of cereal grains that grow above the ground,
mm-hmm.
That can be evaluated, that can be controlled. You could, you know, if you're growing a grain that grows above ground, it all gets ripe at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Tax man can come and take it, or better yet, wait till you put it in the granary and then confiscate the granary. Or if they dislike you, they can burn the crops in the field, and you've destroyed these people's subsistence.
Mm-hmm.
If, on the other hand, you're growing cassava or potatoes or root crop, then this does not work as a tax good. And so, as you said, you can have grain without a state, but you can't have a state without grain, as near as I can tell. It could be millet, it could be maize, it could be rice. And in the Middle East, it's wheat and barley, essentially. And these are, you could also, you can have slavery without a state as well. But you have very few states without slavery.
Hmm. This is the point throughout, is that the population is grown as well to a particular purpose.
Exactly. The problem is, and this is something we know from contemporary demography, that by and large, one of the problems of cities, because they are such epidemiologically dangerous places, is that they are prone to... this concentration of population is prone to produce devastating epidemics. And that means that these early states in particular had to have ways of growing their population in addition to the rate of birth within their own population. And that meant by slavery and capture, as that was the essentially the alternative. I think until the 19th century, essentially, most Western cities only grew by drawing in more people from the countryside because they were fairly lethal in terms of epidemics like cholera and so on. So my guess is, and the evidence is not as rich as I'd like it to be, my evidence is that the disappearance of many of these early states, which blink on and off with great frequency, is that a good many of them were destroyed by epidemics, and they leave very little traces. Unless they leave traces in the bones,
mm-hmm.
It's hard to kind of know what destroyed a city. But cities are disappearing all the time, almost overnight. And if we don't have evidence that the cities are burned, then the question is, why did they disappear? Were they abandoned because of an epidemic? Did most of the population die? Did the crops fail? Or did they have a a disease of their domesticated animals, because the crowding and epidemics are not only true for Homo sapiens, it's true for their domesticated animals and for the concentration of crops of the nearly genetically the same kind close to one another.
Yeah, it's a major point, domestication becoming crowding as much as anything else.
Exactly.
And that crowding allowed for all sorts of new diseases, diseases that had not been seen before.
That was a surprise for me, that what we think of as all the infectious diseases, measles, mumps, and chickenpox would be the most salient for Americans, I think, that these were not diseases that were rare before the early cities, but they simply did not exist. They are the diseases created by the crowding together of domesticated animals and human beings in the same space. So almost all of our infectious diseases are things that move between pigs, sheep, goats, horses, dogs, and so on, and Homo sapiens.
Yeah, a function, again, another result of this great idea of being in a state.
It's time for our final break. This is Panonica, again by New York Art Quartet. It's been called an artful deconstruction of the Thelonious Monk song, jazz seeking even greater freedom of expression. Welcome back to Interchange. I'm Doug Storm. For our final segment of Storied States, Jim Scott discusses the imbalance in our historical record due to the advent of writing. Until recently, we assumed that once civilization existed, that was the only game in town. But that's probably because early villages left behind a written and archaeological record, civilization's waste, so to speak, while the barbarians, ever mobile, were living off the land, unrecorded and sustainably, as we like to say today.
Well, so generally, I again, because of my own, I guess, bringing my own knowledge to the reading of this, it, as I said, it sticks me with the idea of the literate past, I suppose, or the literature of the past. And as you and I talk about this in 2018, again, it's one of those things in which you don't understand how people in this way understood their past, right? How you keep saying throughout, you know, these were experiments, and once a state blinks in and out of existence, where does its history go? Where does its understanding of the experiment go? How does it come about again?
I guess the first thing that is important is that a people can keep its history intact and elaborated and develop it without writing at all.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, the bardic tradition of gathering over the campfire and telling the history of our people and its wanderings and its heroes and its leaders and the spirits that animate us and so on. This is, if you like, a human universal, so that every people carries a kind of culture and a sense of its history. And the interesting thing is, I think, the difference between it being carried as an oral tradition by word of mouth, in which people learn, actually people can learn long passages almost by rote, by imitation, without writing, mm-hmm. and to keep this tradition alive. The interesting thing for me is the what we know about cuneiform is that it, for 500 years, was nothing more than a notational system for the collection of taxes and commercial agreements between merchants and their clients. And only after 500 years did it get to be, a, if you like, a literary writing that had hymns of praise for kings, mm-hmm. had genealogical lists, that had religious incantations to gods and so on.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because it struck me as an interesting confluence. Again, if you imagine 500 years of accounting for the most part, or keeping track of, as you say, trade agreements or something like that, and then there being a literature form that seeks to sing praises. Is that period of time? Is there a particular thing that that maps to in terms of a collapse? And we can talk about collapse also, but in terms of needing to sing the praises of the state, needing to sing the praises of the king at the time, versus just needing to keep track of money or lambs or grain or whatnot.
So the earlier form of, let's say, take hieroglyphics in Egypt, mm-hmm. they are like Chinese characters, kinds of pictograms, and that they do not aim at replicating human speech. Mm-hmm. That is, they can't be kind of read in the way that, let's say, a Latin-derived language that is meant to record spoken text. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that it's only much later that cuneiform develops the forms that allow it to say not just, you know, two dozen sheep, right? Mm-hmm. And a date and the names of the parties who are exchanging them. It's much later that cuneiform begins to take on the forms that mimic human speech, so that you can get something like the Epic of Gilgamesh in the forms in which it has survived for us. Now, the Epic of Gilgamesh obviously did not begin as a written text. Mm-hmm. It was the writing down of what had been an oral text. And we, of course, have only one or two or three versions of this as it was later written down. But like the Odyssey and the Iliad, it was essentially a text recited by bards. Mm-hmm.
This is Doug Storm on Interchange. My guest is James Scott, author of Against the Grain, a deep history of the earliest states, which turns out to be the story of scribes, taxes, and slavery.
Oh, so many fascinating things in the book. The idea, again, for me, it's the what's striking to me is, again, size and relation to population, the way that states have outsized importance in our written imagination, I suppose, written in our libraries, the fact that libraries are state, you know, state form facilities also. These are alongside a larger sort of aspect of living that continues on the edges, as you say, at the periphery, life going on and making use of these states that have sort of become almost oases for barbarians. They're able to pillage the state centers and have a great life.
So, yes, it really did strike me that if one thinks of the traces of civilizations in all our great museums, you cannot but be impressed with the degree to which it made a huge difference whether you built from materials that were lasting, like granite and stone and so on, and if you controlled metallurgy so that you created things of gold and bronze and so on that survived the ravages of time, you got much more space in the museums,
right,
than if, let's say, in Southeast Asia, you had early kingdoms that built from things like bamboo and rattan, wood, essentially, and that were at estuaries of rivers, and they were destroyed by time. And in fact, one of the reasons why I'm dealing with Mesopotamia and why cuneiform is important is that it was written on clay tablets that survived, right, or at least many of them survived, whereas the Egyptians wrote on papyrus, a reed, which was subject to the ravages of time and spoilage and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So if my way of putting it is that if you build with imperishable materials in one place and stack it all up so that the archaeologists can come and dig it, then you get a lot of pages in the history books and you get a lot of space in the museums.
Right.
But if you are on the periphery, even if there are more of you, and even if you're quite sophisticated, and you spread your biodegradable trash widely in the landscape, you just disappear mm-hmm. from the historical record as if you were not there. Now, I should give credit to archaeologists who've become better and better and better over the last couple of decades at understanding sites of hunters and gatherers by sifting through all their material mm-hmm. and so on. So that's being corrected by contemporary archaeology, but not fast enough for my for my mind.
We are finding traces finally then.
Right. You know, they're able, the striking example of this is called coprolites, which are essentially the remains of feces in old outhouses, if you like. And we can reconstruct the diet of people.
Oh, wow.
On the basis of their, I don't know, turds, right? Preserved turds. And
yes, yes.
Out all the materials, we can reconstruct changes in diet over time.
Well, why not? You make this point too in the book that you were somewhat making there, that you know part of how this story continues to be told is that it is a manufacture of kind of how we proceed as making ourselves important in some sense, right? So the scribe becomes important. The scribe actually is at the seat of power. And generally, as we continue to write books and discover seats of certain kinds of power, that is an industry in itself that makes primary these civilizations and, as you say, does not necessarily take account of what is disappeared. Part of the issue, which is interesting still, is that I continue to imagine the sort of, because this is who I am, Jim, I'm going to say it this way, right? It's the idea of the wrongness of much of this, right? The idea, like if we just look at our trash, right? If we look at civilization's waste, which is red through history, right, versus the way of living that produces no waste or trace in a way that has been read, you know, one has served its ecology or environment or whatever we want to call it these days, and one has served to, you know, pretty much destroy and decimate. So they go hand in hand, and this is part of the question of the value of civilization. You know, on one hand, is people and their ways of life are erased, and one way is considered best because it remains while it's clearly been harming the world.
Right. The implication of what you're saying is that if we're going to judge a society by the volume of trash that it leaves behind,
yeah,
then we are obviously at the apex of civilization.
That's right. This is the top, baby.
On the other hand, I guess what I want to emphasize as well is that when we get to writing,
mm-hmm.
the earliest writing is almost invariably produced by, as you call it, the scribes of the state
mm-hmm.
and the high priests and so on. So these are almost always, if you like, propaganda from the top elites.
Right.
Produced, if you like, under their patronage for their purposes,
mm-hmm.
the praise of the state, of the dynasty, of the kings, and so on. And the idea that we should somehow treat these texts
mm-hmm.
as even more valuable historical sources than oral texts,
mm-hmm.
Which are problematic in of themselves, of course. But the idea that these early writing examples are give us the short, direct path to the truth about these states mistakes utterly their function in the early societies in which they were produced.
Mm. Well, that's a beautiful way to say it.
That's our show. We'll close with Karen's Blues, another off of Old Stuff by New York Art Quartet. I hope you'll forgive me as I transmute this into Ursha Nabi's Blues. The homophonic Karen is the ferryman on the River Styx, or River of the Dead in Greek mythology, whose more ancient counterpart is Ursha Nabi, the ferryman of the Huber, River of the Dead in Mesopotamian mythology, and who becomes Gilgamesh's companion after Enkidu dies. By the way, for an extended conversation with Jim Scott, including more on Gilgamesh, Enkidu, and the civilized versus the barbarians, check out the podcast version of this episode at wfhb.org/news/interchange. Our thanks to James Scott for unsettling the official narrative once again. His new book is Against the Grain and is published by Yale University Press. Next time on Interchange, The Political Prisoner. In his new book, Dance in Chains, Padraic Kenny asks, is there any figure in the contemporary world who inspires greater respect than the political prisoner? Kenny reveals the ways prisoners transform and make use of their incarceration in countering states' efforts to control them. The Political Prisoner, next time on Interchange, Tuesdays at 6 p.m. on WFHB. I'm Doug Storm. Thanks for listening. I produce Interchange. Rob Schoon is assistant producer and Bryce Martin is studio engineer. Executive producer is Wes Martin. Stay tuned for the Jazz Menagerie coming up next on your community radio station, WFHB.